Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro, and this week my guest is Philip Elmer DeWitt, founder of Apple 3.0 and longtime editor blogger for Time and Fortune. Philip, thank you for being on the show. It's nice to have you.
Thanks for inviting me. This is an honor.
Yeah, I think you have been on Apple Context Machine with Jeff and Brian before.
Yep.
I was kind of jealous. I wanted to have you on my show, too.
Oh, you flatter me.
It's nice to meet you. I've been reading your stuff for so long, I can't even remember when I started reading your stuff. It's been great.
Well, thanks.
I especially like those summaries that you did at Fortune where you collate the estimates from all of the professionals and the amateurs.
Yeah, that's one of the things I'm bringing to the party, because through Fortune's librarians, I had access to a lot of analyst reports. And there's in the Apple beat, there are 30 or 40, 50 guys who do nothing but follow Apple. You know, because Fortune got the stuff and they were nice enough to share it with me, I was able to do that kind of thing. And in fact, in my new venture, one of the toughest things to do is to get them to send it to me now rather than through Fortune. But I've pretty much got what I used to get through them.
Cool. Well, in the second half of the show, I want to ask you about that and your observations about Apple some more. But typically in the first half of the show, it's sort of like get to know the guest and some background information. So tell me how you got started on all this.
Well, it actually goes back to a computer class I took in high school in 1967, connecting to a Bolt, Beranek, and Newman, one of the a company that was involved in building the early predecessor of the internet. I left that after high school for several years, but then sort of backed my way into journalism. But when I got a job as a temporary secretary at Time Magazine and was looking for a way to make my mark, it turned out that through that high school course and a little bit of programming I did afterward, I knew more about computers than anybody else in the magazine. So as a temporary secretary, I moved pretty quickly into reporter, researcher, and then writer. And I learned very slowly the craft of writing a Time story, which is a very structured thing. And for many years, everything I wrote was completely rewritten. But eventually,
yeah, I was going to ask you about that. How did you feel about having your stuff rewritten?
Well, I'd always wanted to be a writer, but I hadn't, like a lot of people, I hadn't actually written very much. And at Time, they sort of threw you into the bath. You just had to deliver. I was pretty humble. I was happy to learn. In those days, they paid a lot of attention to people they thought had promise, and they were willing to it felt like forever, but probably for 5 or 6 years until I finally got the hang of how you structure a story. I mean, anybody who wants to be a writer should take solace in this, because if they can teach me how to write, they can probably teach anybody. I finally got the knack, and I was writing the early computer stories and then the internet stories up until 1995 when my career crashed and burned. That was what I did for a living. We can go back to how it crashed and burned. It had to do with a cover about internet pornography, but there was a segue. It led me to being a science editor for 12 years at Time, and then I ended up toward the end of my Time career taking a job in San Francisco at a little magazine called Business 3.0 that was a Time Inc. property, and it was on its last legs, and they brought me in to sort of clean up and brighten and lift the copy, as they say. And Josh Quitner, who was writing it, had a rule that anybody who worked there had to write a blog. The secretaries, the art director, and I've told this story many times, so you can tune out if you heard it before, but they were paying $5 per 1,000 page views, and I was flying back and forth between Brooklyn and San Francisco trying to keep my marriage alive. And I thought maybe I could pay for all those JetBlue tickets if I chose the right topic. And I considered writing about sex, but I didn't think my wife would like that. So I decided to write about religion. And the joke is that Apple is like a cult. And sure enough, this blog about Apple that I started was called Apple 2.0, because this was Business 2.0. Mm-hmm. Became the best, not selling really, but it was the most popular blog at Business 2.0 when they killed the magazine and reeled me back to New York to work for Fortune.
Did you run into Leandro Caney at that point in San Francisco? Because he had discovered that there was a cult and he started Cult of Mac.
Yeah, and that's where I got the idea of calling it a cult. It was from him. Anyway, I brought the blog back to Fortune with me, and wasn't really terribly happy as a senior editor at Fortune. And I cooked a deal where I took a retirement package from Time Inc. And then started writing the blog full time for Fortune. And I got an agent at ICM, like a Hollywood agent, and through her was able to negotiate a salary that pretty much brought me back up to what I used to make as a writer at Time, which may be one of the best paid writers, probably one of the best paid bloggers on the internet. I wrote that for about 9 years at Fortune, and you know, kind of under the radar because they weren't paying much attention to their website. But in the last couple of years, since they got spun off from Time Warner, it's a whole other story. Time Inc. and Fortune in particular is one of Time Inc. magazines. It's had to take the blogs much more seriously. They've staffed up. They're going for the page views. And because Apple is sort of sure clickbait, you know, you write about Apple, you get a lot of hits. They have five or six people now doing what I used to do all by myself. And it was getting harder and harder to navigate, you know, find stories to write about that hadn't already been, you know, we used to say in the magazine business that someone hadn't already spit in the soup. Someone had already done it.
Somebody called it the echo chamber.
I finally did what I've been talking about doing, and I probably should have done a couple years ago before, which was get out of the ad-supported legacy media business, which I don't see as going very well. I don't think I see the publishers putting more and more ads on the web pages, more and more aggressive ads. You know, a lot of clickbait of women in bikinis. You won't believe what the photographer saw, and video ads that start running without you asking.
Never click on "you might like."
You might like. So I have been thinking about I've got to get off this. And because I saw people like Ben Thompson and Neil Seabard and in his own way John Gruber making using a new business model where you get paid. Where people subscribe, people pay to read your stuff, which they used to read for free, ad-supported. And the twist I put on it, someone like Ben Thompson, who I admire a lot, I don't know if your readers will know him, but he's very good. He writes a thing called Stratechery.
We've mentioned his article several times at the Mac Observer.
One of the smarter people covering tech these days. And, you know, the problem with going behind a paywall is you become invisible to the spiders that search the web and Google. And Thompson gets around that by once a week putting up a free blog post and then sending stuff the other 6 days. He only sends it to his subscribers.
That's pretty smart. How do you deal with people who feel like they're being subscribed to death and they're having trouble keeping track of all their accounts and payments?
Yeah, well, I think that's a growing problem, and I'm not sure how I deal with it. I think there's a limit to the number of people that can be, you know, that will be subscribed to, and I'm hoping to get in there early enough that I can get a piece of that action. But the fact is that there's a gajillion people on the internet, and there's plenty of attention to be shared. Anyway, that my twist on the Ben Thompson model is, because I find it hard to choose among your babies, you know, which ones you're going to give away and which ones you're going to you want people to pay for. So I find myself writing a lot of stuff that I just put up for free because I haven't added much value. It's like a Twitter, a tweet, You know, here's my little tweet. It has a picture and a couple of paragraphs, but I haven't really done much. And then the ones that I care about and I feel like I've brought some value, I brought something to the table, those are for subscribers only. And then the other twist I put on it is after 3 days, the paywall lifts. So all my old stuff is free. And I'm only asking people to pay for the first 3 days if they want. And you know, if it's valuable for you to get my stuff when it's written, then I ask you for $10 a month.
Can I ask you how that's going?
You know, what I'm hoping to do is get to 1,000 in a year. And until I took a week vacation where everything sort of flatlined, I was it looked like I was going to hit it. I was getting two or three new subs every day. And if I can keep that up, I'll make it. We'll see. And if there it doesn't...
Well, you are a famous and distinguished voice in the Apple world.
Oh, it's nice of you to say.
So I'm not surprised you're doing very well.
No, thanks. Thanks. So does that answer your question about how I got there, or do you want to hear more?
Well, that's a pretty good story. Let's go back a little further. I mean, what were you doing when you were a lot younger? Were you always wanting to be a writer? How did that happen?
Yeah, I think I remember at a very young age really looking forward to retreating to my room and reading a book. I read all the time, and at some point it occurred to me that what I was experiencing through mostly reading novels at that time and being transported into someone else's imagination, that seemed like a really a powerful thing and something that I wished I could do. I didn't see myself as being able to do it, but I wished I could do it. And in my 20s in New York, doing, you know, a bunch of jobs, painting walls, sweeping floors of galleries, writing film strips, and then eventually, I got the bug, the journalism bug with Watergate, like a lot of people. A lot of people in my generation.
The triggering event.
Yeah. And I went to, you know, I clipped all the stories about Nixon and Haldeman and Ehrlichman. And then I got into Columbia Journalism School, which this might give hope to other people. I actually dropped out of because I found I couldn't compose fast enough on a typewriter, which is what we were using back then. I'd been spoiled by computers already. And then I did a bunch of other stuff. I copy edited textbooks. I sold textbooks on the road as a traveling salesman. And then I came to New York and said, at some point I was almost 30, and I thought I just better try this. I better see if I can make a living as a writer. And I spent a year trying to do that. I sold a piece to the Village Voice about a young graffiti artist who ended up becoming famous as Jean-Michel Basquiat, whose paintings now sell for millions of dollars. And then I got this. I was almost penniless, and my teeth needed work, and there were holes in my shoes. When a classmate from Oberlin was going on vacation and offered me a job, you know, a two-week spot, answering the phone at Time Magazine.
Comes full circle. This is good advice for young people. If you have a passion, stay with it. Stay with it. It takes a while. Instant success doesn't always come. Work your network and be prepared to have your writing altered, and be prepared to do some menial tasks for a while and learn your trade, and just keep plugging away if you can, and you'll get there. So many of my guests have told that story.
Yeah, the writing is any kind of writing is a craft that you some people have a knack for it, but you only learn it by doing it.
Yep. Well, this is a good place to take a break. When we come back, I want to ask you about all things Apple. So, folks, stay with us. We'll be back in 60 seconds.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage, where we have a section called Support TMO. or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
And as usual, we're back. Thanks to Kelly for that wonderful spot. Philip, let's talk about all things Apple, since you are an Apple expert. Let's start with the phone, if you'd like. This business of the phone reaching saturation and growth potential not being there anymore, and whether Apple can ignite new interest in iPhone 7. How do you feel about that?
Well, I'm not very sanguine about iPhone 7. I must say that the one thing we seem to have heard about it is that it only has that one plug. That's not a phone that I think I want. The one I actually want is the SE that they just introduced, and I can't do it because they don't have that upgrade plan for it. But taking a step back, I think the iPhone is, most people don't appreciate, how important a product that is, how important the smartphone is. Putting basically what used to be a supercomputer connected to the worldwide, to all the information ever recorded in your pocket, is an amazing thing. And it's not, we're not going to get another one of those, maybe. There's not going to be another new product that earns $600 billion or whatever it is in the space of 7 or 8 years. There's been a lot of attention lately to people looking at the growth curve and looking at how it used to double every year, and now it's growing, then it grew in double digits every year, and then it grew in single digits, and then it stopped growing, and then it actually fell for the first time in 13 years, and thinking that that is some kind of, like that means that Apple is doomed. I think the more valuable chart is the one that Horace Dedu at Asimco does, where he tracks every new technology that comes along, starting with Gutenberg, and going through Whirlpool and television.
Oh, the Gaussian curve.
The Gaussian curve, right? Yeah, well, it's not a Gaussian curve. It's actually an S curve that goes real slowly for the bottom is almost flat as some things don't really catch on for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly they catch on.
Yeah.
And go almost vertical, and they reach saturation, and then they flatten out again. And if you look at the smartphone in the U.S., or the smartphone in Europe, where I just came back from a vacation in France, and everybody in Paris, it seems, most of them have iPhones, and the rest of the ones that don't have Samsungs. And that curve, we're in the modern industrial world, we're at the top of that S curve. So that's just another way of looking at the growth thing that seems to be headed towards doom, and just realize that what you're looking at is a very successful product in a sequence of a lot of successful products that go back to the printing press. So there's nothing to be, there's no big surprise there. The question for Apple is what it does in the future.
Is there a way to ignite that leveling off to a sort of a, kind of ramp the plateau up again, or are we going to stay in steady state?
It's hard to say, never say never, but it's the smartphone as it is now is so good and delivers so much value that anything that as it is now, things that Apple adds to it, features that it adds to it, start to feel like what the in innovation theory they call over-serving. They're giving you something that's too good, and it opens up an opportunity for something that's good enough to come along and take market, which is what all those little Chinese companies are doing.
Reminds me of what Steve Jobs said about the Mac. I'd work it for all it's worth and move on to the next thing.
Yes, right. And that's where we are really with the smartphone. Now, Apple is pitching a narrative that because they have an installed base of, you know, something around a billion devices and probably 600 or 700 million smart iPhones, something in the ballpark there, that they can become a services company, and that's true, and they make more money on they made more money last quarter on services from iTunes to everything else than they did from selling Mac, which tells you something about how this company has evolved. But there's a very smart critique of that theory put forward by Ben Thompson, who we just mentioned, who points out that the functional structure, organizational structure of Apple as it is what they call functional, and it's perfectly aligned with making new products. When you go into the business of services, then you want to be aligned horizontally. And the classic example is DuPont, and I won't go into it, but what Thompson points out is that Apple, to change organizational structure is really risky and may not work. And there's a reason why Google and Amazon are so much better at the cloud stuff than Apple is. And it's not just because there's a lot of reasons, and some of them have to do with at Apple you get ahead by making products, not by making cloud services. So the best people make products. And the other thing is that Google is in the business of selling advertising, which wants as big an audience as possible. And that's aligned with what their mission statement is to put all the world's information in on as many devices as possible, device agnostic. This is like trying to do in a tweet what takes a tree is. Which is to say, I'm pessimistic about how Apple can do it until they come up with the next great thing.
We're going to get to that in just a minute. But before we do that, I wanted to ask you about something you said a few minutes ago, your affection for the iPhone SE. Why is that? Did you always want to have a smaller phone, or is
it? Yeah. I use the phone one-handed. I type with my thumb. I don't want to hold the phone with two hands. And the phone that I have, this iPhone 6S, is too big. You know, you have to sort of shimmy up the phone with your hand to reach that top rightmost icon. It's a bad design. I want that small phone. And I also want to be able to use Apple Pay and all that kind of stuff. So they're making just the right phone for me. And I'm not surprised. Tim Cook is apparently surprised that they can't make them fast enough. I'm not surprised. I'm not the only guy who wants this thing.
What they discovered, I think, was that there was a market for the phablets because Samsung started it and was beating up on Apple. So Apple built larger phones. And then what they discovered was that there were people who also liked smaller phones too, and now I can't make enough of those.
and I think Tim Cook lost a lot of credibility with the analyst community because he was so good at predicting quarter-to-quarter growth and making the right number of phones, predicting what the demand was going to be, and he guessed wrong on two phones in a row. He thought they sold fewer iPhone 6s than they thought they would, and they built too few iPhone SEs, and it's sort of shaken confidence in Cook. I happen to have a lot of confidence in Cook as a manager. He was a great COO, and Steve Jobs couldn't have done what he did with the modern Apple without Tim Cook or his functional equivalent. But whether he can make great products, and I'm looking forward to the car, maybe something that you stick in your ear, and maybe something in your glasses. But you know, it's going to take a while, and Apple's going to be doomed and misunderstood for some years to come.
Yeah, I wrote an article the other day about Apple is both doomed and soaring. They're both stupid and brilliant simultaneously, superposition in the same state.
Yeah. Apple is full of contradictions.
They are. It's a complex company. So Tim Cook met with Jim Cramer a few days ago to talk about Apple and how he's feeling about the company. Do you see that as a sort of an empty PR stunt, or do you see that as an opportunity to really clarify some of these nuances we talked about?
I thought it might have been an opportunity. I didn't think it was all that convincing. I thought Kramer asked the wrong questions. I thought Cook, he's not a good cheerleader. One of the things that made Jobs just so brilliant on the stage was that he was cynical and he told it like it was, and Cook is what's the phrase, painfully sincere. Sometimes it's sometimes cringeworthy. and also, I've got to say that I love that he's the causes he puts his energy behind. The gay rights, the privacy.
Green products.
Sure. The environment, worker, Asian worker supply chain stuff. But it's not aligned with Apple's mission statement of making great products in the way that Steve Jobs was clearly aligned with making great products. Now, there's nothing that Jobs did that wasn't, he would not have gotten involved in any of those things because it wasn't about making great products.
Well, some people argue that Steve Jobs had to focus on the iMac and Jonathan Ive's help to resurrect the company and save it from disaster. Because great products were the only thing that mattered in 1997 to 2004-5.
Oh.
And then, when the iPod took off and Apple started diversifying, then the company became so big that singular focus on every great product to save the company transitioned into a mature company that was very big and doing lots of things. I've seen that argument. What do you think?
Well, I'm not sure I'm not sure it took anybody's eye off the important ball, which is making the next great product, making a product that's better than any other product in the category and that can be made, sold to mass markets at high margin. That's what Apple does. And it does it under Tim Cook, but we're at this weird transition where they've made the best product anyone's ever seen since the car or something. The iPhone is really special and it's going to be hard for them to match it. They don't have to. But Cook is trying to say, what he was trying to say on Kramer, I think, was that the smartphone market doesn't have to grow exponentially for Apple to be successful and for Apple to bridge to the next great product. Whether they can beat Tesla and GM and everybody else to to the automobile market, it remains to be seen. We know they're working on it, but with Apple, you they can work on things, but they may not necessarily bring it to market.
Do you think the car is almost certain in that respect, or do you think it's just a research R&D thing?
Well, that's what I'm saying is it's clearly a research R&D thing. Whether there's a way that Apple can bring it to market and do I expect Apple to do with that what they did with everything else, is to go after the most profitable segment of the market with a product that's focused on the user experience, that just works, that you can bring into the automobile genius bar, and have it supported in a way that most cars aren't, that is sold in a way that is the opposite of a car salesman.
How do you think Apple will sell a car? Do you think that they'd sell it through their current retail stores? Would they open up a new chain of stores?
Well, you couldn't fit them in the stores as they exist
right
now. And they couldn't even fit a television set in the stores.
Might buy bigger space.
It's not hard to imagine an automobile dealership that you would love to just visit the way people
visit.
That
you might even
Apple
stand
stores.
In line for, say, like Tesla?
Well, Tesla has shown that people will stand in line for an electric car.
How do you outdo Tesla? Now, Tesla's got this task now of ramping up to build maybe 200,000 cars in 2017 and 18. Apple's going to be a little bit behind by a few years. Will Tesla so grasp this market that Apple will be at a Johnny Come Lately, or does Apple have an opportunity to learn great things from Tesla's mistakes?
The latter. I think the Apple, it's a typical Apple product introduction, watches other people get parts of it right and parts of it wrong, and then comes out with a product that so clearly does everything better that that people will stand in line for it. Tesla, you know, is this you take as big a risk underestimating Elon Musk as you do underestimating Donald Trump. But you know, whether he can deliver is a question. I'm pretty sure Trump's not going to get elected, and I'm not sure that Elon Musk is actually going to make it to Mars. But he's done a lot of things right, and one of them is very similar to Apple, and he's attracted great talent with a really ambitious mission goal, which really is to take, you know, to go to Mars. So he was able to get, you know, in his SpaceX venture, the very best people who would have otherwise worked for NASA, where nothing is going on, they now all want to work for Tesla, for SpaceX.
Right.
And there's something similar going on in the electric car business, and Tesla's been able to attract great engineers. Now, Apple, you know, unfortunately, they have venture capital money that's pretty limited, Apple is able to steal some of their best people back. I'm not the guy to ask about the car business. I wouldn't put money in Tesla. I wouldn't be afraid of putting money in Apple, but then I don't invest in Apple because I'm not allowed to.
Interesting.
I want to have a stick in the fire and write about the company. Anyway.
Before we wrap up, I want to ask you one more thing. Mm-hmm. About the future of the iPad. The iPad is a product that was the right product for its time. Everybody who wanted one bought one. Now people are using their larger smartphones. They've got an iPad that they bought a few years ago. It does everything they need to do. Do you think the iPad is a temporary product category, bridging a gap? Or do you think it's got some life?
I think it's at the top of that S curve we talked about before. Mm-hmm. That it's in its current form, it's pretty quickly reached saturation among the people who want it, and which tends to be a sort of a first world thing because it's like the third device. You know, whereas in the rest of the world, the developing world, which is where the new markets are emerging, it's the smartphone. If you're only going to have one computer in most of the world, it's going to be the smartphone. Yeah. So I don't see the iPad making big inroads there. I've bought several iPads. I give the old ones to my parents. I'm not sure I'm going to buy another one. I'm not sure I'm ever going to buy another one.
Interesting. Okay, well, that's about all we have time for. That's a fascinating perspective. I'm so happy you had a chance to come on the show and talk to us. I really appreciate it. Tell them.
I'm happy to have been invited.
It's great to hear your perspectives. We've been wanting to get you on this show for a while, so thank you. Tell the listeners how to contact you.
Well, I have a Twitter account at Philip ED with one L. What I really need is subscribers to my new website. I call it Apple 3.0, and the address is ped30.com.
We'll put that in the show notes. Make sure everybody can find you. So this has been cool. Thank you very much. And listeners, I hope you enjoyed the show as well. Thanks for coming by. We'll see you next time on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.